So let us start. So today I will start the second part of my lectures. Namely, I will give an introduction to the theory of renormalization and renormalization group in quantum field theory. So up to now, what we have been doing has been just I gave you a set of tools to compute physical quantities, like basically Green functions, so expectation value of products of operators in some simple quantum field theory based basically on the scalar bosonic field. But I didn't discuss at all what are the properties of those objects. So I gave you rules to compute them. I saw that you can organize, for instance, the perturbative expansion in terms of an expansion in terms of with diagrammatic rules, and you played with that. I show that it's possible, at least in principle, to play the same kind of rules with fermions. But I didn't discuss at all the properties of the object we are calculating. And that's what we are going to do today. And we shall discuss one of the most important aspects in quantum field theory, which is something different from ordinary non-relativistic quantum theories, which is the appearance of short distance or high energy singularities in the behavior. The behavior of a relativistic quantum theory is very, very different at high energy than the behavior of a non-relativistic quantum theory, because nothing, you can go up to infinite energy in ordinary non-relativistic quantum theory, nothing happens. The speed is faster, is higher, the kinetic energy is bigger, but that's all. While in quantum theory, in a relativistic quantum theory, it's very different, and in fact, it's much more interesting. And also, it gives you constraints on the structure of the theory, which are much stronger than in ordinary quantum mechanics. So in fact, relativistic invariance gives very, very strong constraints on the structure of quantum field theories. And this is contained partly, not only, but partly in the theory of renormalization. Okay, so I will start again from the theory we started from, which is the scalar field, the free scalar fields, right? I will start from the free scalar field. Okay, so no interaction, it just has a mass m, okay? This mass might be zero or non-zero, but at the moment I will take it non-zero. And I will be interested in the short distance behavior of the correlation function, of the Green function. So let me remind you that we have seen that basically the basic object is the propagator, that's a Feynman propagator, so this is expectation value in the vacuum of the time-ordered product of two field operators. Those are operators. And this is basically, this is the Feynman propagator of x minus y. And it behaves, we have seen that it behaves basically at short distances as a power 2 minus d, where d is the dimension, is 4 is the dimension of space-time. Okay, we have discussed that when discussing the properties of the propagator. And this is of course the square root of the by x minus y. I mean the square root of x minus by x by of x mu g mu nu x nu. Where is the g mu nu is just, remember, minus plus 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 with my sign convention. Okay? And you can consider this object in an Euclidean metric, so in imaginary time, where the metric is plus 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 plus, and that's exactly the same, it has the same behavior for short value of the space interval between the two points. And this signs us a problem because you cannot really define, well, the object at two points, so the operator phi squared at two two coinciding points is not well defined. You see? Because this is infinite, because the dimension is larger than 2. And in fact, this has a consequence, which is, remember, in all the Feynman diagrams we were drawing and just starting to compute when discussing the perturbative expansion of the 5-4 theory, we always had a diagram like that. One or two. We had a diagram like that, which is often called the tadpole diagram, because it's. And this quantity, in fact, by the Feynman rules, just represents the expectation value in the vacuum of phi of x squared. I will drop the fact that I'm computing in the vacuum in the time order product, and I write this just like that, okay? And this is a point where this vertex lie. And so everywhere we had diagram like that, which gives an amplitude which is proportional to the expectation value of this products of two operators at the same point. And therefore, this means that this is infinite, because this is given by this integral. We can rewrite this also in this way. This is this integral. It's a Fourier transform of the propagator. Therefore, this is something like that with a factor. Well, if you are, this is minus I minus epsilon. If you are in the real time, and this is infinite because this integral is divergent at infinity. Okay? So this is in fact infinite. So, what's going on? And so you see that in order to define such an operator, you have to be more careful in a quantum field theory. And in fact, one can define operators. One can build out operators, namely observable of the theory, which give you information between the behavior of products of field at the same point. But one has to take into account the fact that naively this object is divergent. Okay, so how to define what is called composite operator, which means products, well, operator builds out of products of this operator, and its special derivative, for instance, at the same point. Okay. And this will be, in fact, it's not just a mathematical game. We shall need composite operators when studying the theory, because, for instance, we have seen that when starting to perform the perturbative expansion for the 5-4 theory, we were computing expectation value of 5-4 operators. So we had to compute expectation value containing this operator. This is products of 4 phi operators at the same point. And this, since this is already divergent, this is even more divergent. And that's, in fact, part of the divergence of this operator is contained in this diagram. But we need to define that in order to make a sensible, to define a sensible interacting theory out of the scalar field. Okay. So the answer is from how to define such composite operator is, in fact, contained in how to study the short distance behavior of products of operators. Because after all, you see that these problems, the fact that this is divergent, come from the fact that we are computing the expectation value of the products of 2 phi operators. You get something which is singular at short distances. Okay? And in fact, when you consider the product of many, many operators, there will be more general singularity, but of the same type. Okay? And so the study of this problem is encoded in the short distance behavior of products of operator. And this short distance behavior of products of operator is encoded in a very, very important and very interesting structure, which is called Wilson operator product expansion. And it's called operator OPE for operator product expansion. And that's one very, very, very important feature of quantum field theories, which is everywhere in any local field theory, you have an operator product expansion. It is often one of the most important tools to study and to characterize the properties of the theories. It contains a lot of information about the structure of the theory and its consistency. Okay. And I will show how these operator products exist in a very, very simple case of the free scalar field. And later on, we shall use it to study the renormalization of the interacting theory. Okay, so let us see what this is. Let us give a simple example. So let us first consider, I will be interested in the expectation value. Expectation value means always expectation value in the vacuum of a time order product of operator, but I didn't know this. And I imagine that I have a product of phi, operator, phi of z1, et cetera, and somewhere I have two operators, phi of zn, for instance. Okay. I'm interested in computing a correlation function of many, many operators, and I'm just interested in what's happening in this correlation function when those two operators, those two x and y, come close together. You see? So this, I can take operator, this here, you have a picture, for instance, where you have here, you see, you have here your space-time, you have events here, x1, and I'm interested in what's happening when two of the points in space-time come close together, and only those two points. The other points remain fixed, at a fixed distance, okay? So. And I am computing this in the case of the free theory. Okay, so this is for the free theory. And therefore, this is given by a sum over Feynman diagrams, sum over products of propagators using Big theorem. So we have the contribution where you have all the, you compute all the possible combination of propagators obtained by pairing those points 2 by 2. And you take the product, and that's key. It's just a Wick theorem. Okay. Now, in this sum, you have two very, very different contributions. You can separate this contribution in two contributions. First, so let me just draw a picture like that. You have first a contribution where, so let me, instead of writing this picture, I will write the picture like that. I have a box. The box represents space-time. The dots represent the position of the points where the phi operator. And this has all the z's, okay? And this is x and this is y, okay? And the box means that here I am considering the sum of the contribution of all the pairings obtained by using Wick theorem. So this means simply, this box means that I'm taking the sum of products of all possible pairings. So this one, this one, this one, but this one. Now you see that in all those different pairings, you have two different kinds of pairings. The pairings where X is paired with Y, and the pairings where X is paired with one of the Z, and Y is paired with another one of the Z's. Okay? And of course, so let us write it first. The first contribution will be this one. Okay. So there is a contribution which is described by this contribution. So I have a propagator between X and Y, and then a product of propagator, which are always in between points in the remaining set of the Zs. Okay? And then you have the other contribution, which I draw like that, where you have your Zs here, but here, X is paired with some of the Zs, and Y is paired with another one of the Zs. Okay? So it's just here a pictorial way to separate the sum of propagators into those two contributions. Okay? So this means, this object means this object. So this is phi of z, let us rewrite it, phi of x, phi of y, times the products of a phi of z. Okay? What is this? By Vick's theorem, this is just, this line represents just the propagator, which is the vacuum expectation value of the products of the only two operators, phi of x times phi of y. Okay? But then what is this? This is just the expectation value of all the other operators. You see? And this is something else. Okay. So now I am interested in the behavior when x and y goes to z. So for instance, let us consider that x goes to y. Okay? This becomes singular because the propagator is singular, but this doesn't contain any singularity. But when x goes to y, nothing happens to the propagator, because here you have the propagator between x and another point. Here a propagator is y with another point. So this is something which is perfectly regular. Okay? So this is singular, because this is singular. This is regular, because it's a product of propagator at points which remain at a finite distance. And this last term is regular. So you see that when you are computing a product of an arbitrary large number of operators, the singularity when two operators are located at points which can come close together is always contained in the behavior of the propagator, namely the correlation function of two points. You see? Okay. So now, I will do something very stupid. I will write that when, since this is just a function, this is a function of x and y, let me rewrite the product, this expectation value of products of phi z1 zn as the products of operator here when I have added the operator 1 at point, let us say, y or x. Okay? I define the operator identity. The operator identity is just an operator which acts on the states of the theory by just mapping a state into the same states. It's the operator 1 in the algebra of all possible operators acting on states, so it's a part. And since this operator doesn't change anything, I can assign it to any position of the point of space-time. So I can assign it to the point y, for instance. I'm free to do that. Of course, the operator 1 located at point y has the same action that the operator 1 located at point x or at point z, but so it's the same operator, but it's just a label. Okay. So I can write the expectation value of any product of field as the expectation value of any product of fields times 1, because the expectation value of 1 of the identity operator is 1. Okay. You don't change anything in the space of states. Okay. Good. So now, I have a function time and expectation value where I have an operator times this. Now let us Let us, so now I will do something else. I will define, by definition, I will define the contribution of all these other terms as the product of an object, which I'll call phi of phi of x, phi of y, with just some double dots here, you see, times the other operator. So that's a, take this as a definition of this object. This object is defined as this expectation value of products of operator minus the products of all the expectation value of those operators minus the expectation value of those two operators. See? So for the moment, it's just a definition of this object. Okay. You see? So then this is in fact an object which in fact you can consider it as an operator acting on the space of states of your theory by the very simple definition that I can define that the these products with double dot of two operators at two different points, I define it as those two operators, phi of x times phi of y, minus the expectation value of phi of x, phi of y in the theory, times the operator identity located, let us say, at point y. This is, I define this operator, and from that I can define an object, which is an operator of the theory, which is an operator, a product of two operators of the theory, minus another operator of the theory, times a function of the position, of the respective position allocated to those two operators. So that's another operator of the theory. It's just a linear combination of one operator of the theory, which is well defined. It's a non-local operator, but it's an operator of the theory. It's an operator which acts on the state of the theory, minus some complex number, the propagator, times an operator, which is the identity operator. So this object is called a normal product. That's of two operators. Okay, and what are the properties of this operator? Okay. So this operator, you see, the property of this operator is that its expectation value are well defined when x goes to y, when you take the expectation value of these operators times products of operator at another point. So as an operator, this operator is well defined when x goes to y. Why is it well defined? Because any of its matrix elements between the vacuum of any operator, of products of operator, any of its matrix elements is well defined when x goes to y, because any of its matrix elements is given by a sum of Feynman diagrams, products of propagator, where there is never a propagator between x and y, because this object has been defined, by definition, it has been defined as phi of x minus phi of y when I decide to remove any contribution coming from a propagator between x and y. You see? So this object, this operator, it's an operator which depends on two points, on x and y. But as an operator, it is well defined when x goes to y, because any of its matrix element is well defined, is finite. You see? Yes?
Are we considering that infinity minus infinity is finite?
No, I am considering. When x is different from y, this is finite, this is finite, this is finite, this is finite. Simply, I know that this is infinite when x goes to y. I know that this is infinite when x goes to y, but this is finite. So I have something which is finite, finite, finite. But I know that this becomes infinite when x goes to y. This becomes infinite as x goes to y, but in the same rate. Therefore, this is finite. So you can state that indeed infinity minus infinity is equal to infinity, but only in the limit when x goes to y. So I am indeed subtracting the singular part of this object. Yes?
So it's supposed to be obvious from the definition that this remains finite as x goes to y, or do you need to look at the line above it?
Well, it's defined by this product. So it's obvious from the definition, but you have, because the definition is made up. By definition, you see, by definition, now any in a quantum field theory, you can basically build any state psi of the free field. You can build them out of operators phi of z of phi of z n acting on the vacuum of your theory, because the phi contains creation and annihilation operator of the field, and out of the phi or the Fourier transform, you can construct all the states of the free field. All the states in the full space of the free field theory can be constructed by applying various phi operators to the vacuum. Okay. So now this means that when I'm considering any matrix element between two different states of this operator, since these objects are constructed out of applying phi to the vacuum, I can always write this as a linear combination of vacuum times some phi times the operator I am interested, times some phi. So any matrix element in the Fock space of the free field of this normal product, this operator, can be written as a linear combination of matrix elements in the vacuum of products of phi times this operator times products of phi. You see? Which are defined by the sum of this contribution, which are always finite when x goes to y. So in the sense of an operator, all the matrix elements of this operator are well defined when x goes to y. So the limit when x goes to y of this operator is well defined in the sense of an operator acting on the space of Fock space. You see? Well, I'm not discussing a very precise definition of what is the topology in the space of operators, so that's beyond this point. But where is he? Where is it? Yeah, I think I don't have it. So finally, you see that this limit is well defined, and this will be a good definition of what is the product of this operator. So now you see that as a definition, I can define an operator which is phi squared of y as the limit when x goes to y of the normal products of the two operators, phi of x, phi of y. This defines an operator which is the normal product of two phi at the same points. So I can note it either as normal products of phi squared at the same point, or I can write it also as usually one defines them, one use both notation, you see. But in fact, this has to be understood really as a normal product of two operators defined in this way in the space of operators. And I'm considering this operator, which is a local operator, at the point y. So this is a local operator. This is a local operator because it's located at the point y. And it is finite. contrary to the naive products, phi of x minus phi of y. You see? And this operator is defined, therefore, as the limit when x goes to y of this operator minus this function times this operator. You see? Yes?
Everything we've done till now, the fields have been just functions, right? So how are we supposed to think of the relative?
Okay, the fields are functions within the functional integral.
Okay.
But here I am considering expectation value of those fields. So this object in the framework of functional integrals or of fast integral are expectation value of random fields, of random variables which are the field. In the framework of canonical quantization, these are matrix elements in the vacuum of time-ordered products of operators. So these are either random variables in the framework of path integral formalism, and you are taking expectation values of these random variables, or in the framework of canonical quantization, these are operators, and this is a matrix element of this product of operator. But I am using the same notation for phi, whether it is an operator or whether it is a random variable. You see? But so I am using the term operator for both terms. Okay. But here I prefer to think of them as operator, or if you prefer, as observable of the theory. Because here I am dealing by such a kind of relation. It's a relation which is true for any matrix element of this object. So when I'm writing this, I'm writing that this relation is true whenever you take any other products of phi and you take the expectation value of that. So it's a relation which is true for this object inserted in any expectation value or any matrix element in the vacuum with other operators. So it's a relation which is true for operators, for the operators corresponding to this quantity. So it's an operational, it's a relation for operator. So it's a normal product of two operators, or if you prefer, observable of the theory. It's a point which is important.
But does the normal product have any meaning if you think of them as functions?
In two terms?
If you think of them as functions, then the normal product has no meaning?
It has a meaning, but we shall see. It has a meaning, but think of it in terms of random distribution. I already discussed the fact that the fields which contribute, so the phi considered as random variables in the functional integrals, are in fact distributions. They are very, very wild objects, and we are integrating over very, very wild objects. Okay? So these are not normal functions, but these are quantum fields, in fact. Those objects are quantum fields, or if you prefer, field operator in a quantum theory. But, okay? Okay, so, but now you can say something more. I've given you a rule, you know, as how to define an operator which is the continuum limit of a product of two field operators at the same point. And this is given by this rule, which means that I subtract the divergent part, which is given by the propagator, and I keep the rest. So I subtract all the diagrams which contain this, and I keep with this. You see? Okay. So there is an equivalent. So basically, well, this is the first definition. Phi squared of x, so this is the first definition. Phi squared of y is the limit when x goes to y, I'm rewriting what I wrote here, of the operator phi of x, phi of y, minus the expectation value of phi of x, phi of y in the theory times the operator 1, if you prefer, but it's 1 of y. That's a point y. Okay, so that's the definition in terms of operators. Okay? But now, so that's the first definition in the continuum theory. But you see that you can you can write it in a formal way as phi squared of y equal phi of y squared minus the expectation value of phi y times one. Okay. So that's the definition one for this product of operator. You have an equivalent way to define it, which is, for instance, put the theory on a lattice. Put the theory on a lattice in space-time. Which means that, in fact, introduce what is called, introduce an ultraviolet regulator of the theory. For the theory. And introducing an ultraviolet regulator for the theory means, in fact, changing the propagator of the theory so that this integral becomes convergent for large k. And this can be performed, for instance, by introducing a lattice or by changing the value of the propagator. So you change a little bit the theory so that it has a better ultraviolet behavior. Then, there are no more any singularities at short distance. Because you have a minimum, you have a minimal distance a, so you have a minimal distance a, or equivalently a maximal momentum lambda. You see, so one way to define this object is, for instance, to change the theory so that the momenta in this integral, the momenta are always smaller than lambda. And this becomes finite. So in that case, this object is always finite, even when x goes to y. And this object is always finite, even when x goes to y. OK. And then the second definition is that this object, so in that case, phi squared of x minus the expectation value of phi squared of x times the identity is defined. But check that if you are using, for instance, a definition for this for the propagator or something like that, the limit when the short distance regulator goes to zero, that this limit exists and is gives you also the normal products of the two operators at point x. So you see, you have two equivalent definitions. Either you consider the products of two operators at different points, you subtract the divergent point, and you take the short distance limit, or you introduce a regulator for the theory. Then this operator becomes finite. You subtract its expectation value in the vacuum times one, and you get an operator which is also ultraviolet finite when A goes to zero, when the ultraviolet regulator goes to zero. In fact, you recover the same operator. You see? So that's two equivalent ways to define what is the normal product of two operators. Okay. So once we have done that, so those two definitions are equivalent. They give you the same operator at the end. So once you have done that, you can continue the game. And I've detailed in much detail explained what's going on for in the case of the product of two fields. But once you have done that, you can continue and define products of more than two operators. Okay, and in the following, what we shall need is basically phi 4. So can we define the same thing for the products of 4 operators? We shall need it heavily in when discussing renormalization theory for the interacting phi 4 theory. Okay. So in that case, you can play exactly the same game. When you are computing a product of, you have 4 phi here, and you have, so these are the x's, and these are the z's. And I'm considering the expectation value of products of phi's, where you have phi x, which will, four phi's of x1, xn, which will come close together. And the z's will remain far away. So here, the x means that I have x1, x2, x3, and x4, which goes to some x, let us say. And z1, zn, stay at a finite distance between themselves and x. And I'm computing an expectation value of products of those 4 plus n fields. And you see that in this, now I apply the Vick theorem, and I have several contributions. I have the contribution where you have all the x are paired together, and all these objects are, so these are unpaired. And this is very singular because you have 2 propagators. Then you have a contribution where you have 2 of the x's are paired together, and 2 of the x's are paired with some z's. This is less singular, but this is singular. And then you have a finite contribution where all the z's are paired together. All the x's are paired with some z's. But here now, applying the Vick theorem, you see here that you have 3 possible, 3 ways to do that, because you can pair this one and this one, or this one and this one, etc. And here, in fact, you have six ways to obtain that, because you can pair x1 with x2, or x1 with x3, or x1 with x4, or x2 with x3, or x2 with x4, etc. So you have 3 different contributions here, and 3 different contributions here. And here, you have only one contribution coming from that. OK? So, yes. OK. So, and now let us define that this will define the normal products. This contribution only will define the normal products. This will define the normal product operator phi 4 of x. So what does this amount? This amounts to subtract to the operator phi 4 of x the contribution which comes from 2 propagators. So this amounts to state that phi 4 of x is the limit when, well, for instance, let us take this formula because it's a simpler thought. The limit when the regulator goes to 0 of this contribution, which is the operator phi 4 of x, the naive products of 4 operators. This gives you, so I subtract to this the contribution of this, but this is a product of 2 operators, so this is minus phi squared of x squared times the operator 1. Okay, and I have a factor of 3 because I have 3 ways to obtain a term like that, because I have 3 possible, 3 terms coming from the Vick theorem. So by subtracting these terms to these terms, I get only those 2 terms. Then I must subtract this one. But what is this one? This term one, this term is one propagator, so one phi squared x. Okay? And what is this term? This term represents a normal product of 2 phi times the product of those operators. So this term represents phi squared, but this term represents a normal product of 2 phi, the way we have defined them before. So this term represents, to subtract this term, I have to subtract an operator which is the normal product of phi squared at point x times the propagator and with a factor minus 6. You see? Okay. And what this kind of picture, this diagrammatic picture of state me, ensures me that this object as an operator is well defined as an operator. Exactly in the same way that phi squared was well defined as an operator. You see? Okay, so this goes on. And you see, at that level, it's just application of the Vick theorem. So after that, I can define normal products of phi cube, of phi 6, of phi. I can define what is the normal products of 2 operators, of 5 operators, etc. By applying the same rules, okay? Good. So this is the rules to define operators, which are well defined in the sense that any matrix element of this combination of operators has a well defined limit, ultraviolet limit. You see? Good. Okay. So once we have this operator, the definition of these operators, I will explain you what is the operator product extension. Okay. So, in fact, I need something more. I have defined the operator. You see, I have defined the normal products of 2 operators at 2 different points. Let us call it x1 and x2 now, as by definition, phi of x1, phi of x2, minus phi, the expectation value to the propagator, times the operator identity. And I have seen that this operator is well defined in the sense that any of its matrix elements is regular when x goes to y. Because it's given by this operator, it's given by the sum of all those diagrams. Where here we have x1, x2, and here. So all matrix elements of phi of these products are given by this kind of operators. You see?
On the left-hand side of x2 and x1, is the ordering important there? Or?
Pardon?
The left-hand side of the definition of x2.
It's not important because, as usual, I start from operators which are normal ordered. So in the left-hand side, these operators are also normal ordered. So there is the same implicit rules of normal ordering, which is defined in this definition. Yes? What did I say?
Normal ordering.
No, I'm sorry, I meant time ordering. Yes. Always, so there is always time ordering implied in this definition. Time ordering is time ordering is there. Okay, so now there is something more. Not only this operator is well defined when x goes to y, but you see that it's completely regular when x goes to y. X and y can cross each other without seeing each other because they don't see each other. So this, as a function of x and y, is in fact a differentiable function. So this is fully fully regular in x1 and x2. So this means that if you can, for instance, take the derivative of this object, it's well defined too. Not only the propagator is singular, but its derivative with respect to is singular. So this object is singular, therefore, in the sense of an operator, you can define a Taylor expansion. Taylor expansion in x1 mu in the coordinates x1 mu and x mu 2 makes sense. Okay? Because here you have a propagator between x1 and some z, which is a function, which is a function which is fully regular, so it exists, its derivative exists, etc. Except if you are on the light cone, but it's not very important at that stage. So it's a function which is regular almost everywhere except on the light cone. So you can make sense of defining what is d over d x1 mu d over dx1 mu1 mu p of phi of x1 times d over dx2 of mu of, let's say, nu 1 d over dx2 of nu q of phi of x2. This operator doesn't make sense at coinciding points because it contains an object which is very singular. But defining, you can define this object, okay, simply by saying that each matrix element are the derivative with respect to the position of the matrix element of this object, because this object is fully regular when x goes to y. So I can define, in fact, I can define this object, y squared, these products of two propagators at point x, simply as the limit when x1 goes to, and x2 goes to x, to some point x, of the special derivatives, d over dx, of the normal products of this operator, because this has also a well-defined limit. Okay? So not only I am able to define, so with this trick, which is just using the Wick theorem and subtracting the singular part, I have defined not only the operator normal products of two operators, but I have defined also what is the normal products of an arbitrary number of derivative of phi times an arbitrary number of
the left hand side. I'm a bit confused on the square bracket. Is there a minus sign between the two sign or two
the square bracket? There is no minus sign, it's just a product. I define the normal product, the normal order products of space-time derivative of the field phi times space-time derivative of the field phi as the limit of the derivative of this operator. Yes?
I think the variables of the two fields, phi x and phi x, yes, x1 and phi x2, to be independent, because if you do that, it means you are taking derivative of phi x1 only with respect to phi x1.
Yes.
So are you considering the two variables where they...
I'm considering the two x1 and x2 are independent. I take the some derivatives with respect to x1, so those derivatives act on the first phi. I take some derivative with respect to x2. Those gives this, and then
I take the limit when x1 goes to x2. And this defines the product of the derivative. So I can define products of derivatives of phi exactly in the same way, and it's also well defined. So p is the number of derivatives acting on the first phi, q is the number of derivatives acting on the second phi, and of course this kind of derivative operator contains a bunch of Lorentz indices that I wrote here, but I have not written them here, but this contains a bunch of Lorentz indices. So I can define in the same way products of derivative of operator, and they are also well-defined operators. Yes?
Is there a constraint on p plus q?
Is there
a constraint on p plus q? Should be n.
A conti?
Constraint, a constraint on p, because you say take some derivative respect.
No, there are no constraints. You can take one derivative from the first phi and 1,000 derivatives on the second phi. Yes?
Should there be, inside the limits, should the derivative be del by del x1 and del by del x2?
So I take p derivative of x with respect to x1, q derivative with respect to x2. Here there are some Lorentz indices, but I don't write them because this is a tensor object. I take those derivatives on the matrix element of this operator, and once I've been doing that, I take the limit x1 and x2 goes to the same point. You see? And this object is well defined because x1 is different from x2. This object is well defined when I take the derivative, and what I am claiming is that because it's given by a sum of Feynman diagrams where which those contributions are perfectly regular, or in fact, infinitely differentiable, when x1 goes to x2, except possibly on the light cone, this object is well defined. Okay? So since any of its matrix elements are well defined, this object is, as an operator, well defined. Okay. So with this trick, not only we have been able to define what is the products of two operators, but what are products of space and time derivatives, space-time derivative of operators. And this goes on, of course, for phi 4, etc. So you can define the same thing for products of C operators, products of phi 4 operators. You can add derivatives to any of the fields, and this built an operator which are fine. Okay. You see? So now, what is this useful for? Because up to now, I have just, as always, constructed some object. Now, I start again from this definition. Okay? And I will invert it again. So I start from this definition. The products of two operators, it's not a normal order product. It's just not a normal product. It's just an ordinary product of those two operators. We have seen that it's phi of, it's the propagator times the operator 1 plus this operator, this normal product, which is well defined. You see? So this is singular. This is regular because any of its derivative exists. So now I can make a Taylor expansion on that, but I cannot make a Taylor expansion of that. Okay. So I can rewrite in a very formal way that when x1 and x2 goes to x, let us say, well, let us choose the point to be the origin for simplicity. I can make a Taylor expansion on that. Okay? Because this is differentiable. So I can write this as phi of x1, phi of x2 times the operator identity
plus, and then I write a Taylor expansion. So I write something which is sum over P and Q, 1 over P, 1 over Q, x1 to the power P, x2 to the power Q, times the normal order, the normal product of the derivative over the P with respect to x of the first phi times the derivative over the Q with respect to phi of the second operator taken at zero. Okay, so that's just the Taylor expansion. Taylor expansion around x1, x2 equals zero. Okay, so I wrote here a Taylor expansion by writing here just that P, P and Q are integer, but in fact, P and Q contains integer, so this is a tensor, but that's a shortened notation for. This is a shorthand notation for Taylor expansion in d dimensions, dimensional space. So that, in fact, P means a collection of P mu's. So we are doing P mu derivation in the time in the mu direction, and P and Q's are collection of Q mu's, where I'm doing Q mu derivation with respect to the x, the mu coordinate of the coordinates Q. And so this is, in fact, a collection of powers, and there is a definition slightly more involved for what is the factorial of vector made out of numbers. But that's a shortened notation for that. Okay. So you see that I can write the products of two operators at different points at short distance as a sum of terms. And here this sum is very simple. Here there is a term which is a regular term which comes from the Taylor expansion. So this is fully regular. This, if phi were regular functions, you know, smooth function, for instance, classical solution of the equation of motion, this term would always be there. So this is a classical term. This is a new term which comes from the fact that the theory is quantized because it contains a propagator, and the propagator is a quantum object. You see? So remember that, in fact, in the quantum field theory, in the real quantum field theory, there is an h-bar here. The propagator is of order h-bar. So, in fact, this term is of order h-bar. So this is a new contribution coming from quantum fluctuations. Okay? And this new contribution is singular. Okay? And this contribution is proportional to an operator, which is the identity operator here. It's a well-defined operator. But it's an operator which doesn't appear in the classical expansion of a product of two fields. Because when you take the classical expansion of a product of two fields, the first term is phi squared itself, this term, which comes from P equals Q equals zero. Then you have products of derivative of the field, but you never have a product of zero fields, because you started from a product of at least two fields. And since you are in a non-interacting theory, you cannot generate products of four fields or five fields, etc., because it's a free theory, so you have no interaction between the bosons of the particles. If the theory was interacting, you could generate, and you would generate, even at the classical level, products of four fields, of six fields, because of the equation of motion, because the waves interact, even at the classical level. But you would never get this, because in order to get this, basically, you need to annihilate particles. And that's a purely quantum phenomenon. OK?
So this is a new term. Here it's almost trivial to see that it's there. It's there from the very beginning because it's the most singular term, but it's the quantum term. Okay? And now, so you see that now I will give a very general. I can write the products of those two operators, phi of x1 times m2, as a sum over operators, quantum operators, that I will write, OA, okay, times a function of x1 minus x2, which is in fact labeled by the operator, times OA. In fact, I can write this as x1 and x2 times OA when x1 and x2 goes to 0 times O1 located at the operator 0. So you see they can write in a bit schematic way the expansion of this product of two operators when x1 goes to x2. I can expand it as a sum over local operators. Here the local operators are one and all the products of derivative of the two fields times some coefficient, you know. This is an operator. Okay. And this is a function of x1 and x2. You see? So this is an operator, this is an operator, the product is an operator. I expand this product of operator as a sum of operators times some coefficients. And the coefficient contains the short distance behavior of the theory. You see? So those coefficients here, what are they? For the operator 1, the coefficient is the propagator. And for those operators, the coefficient is this function. It's a polynomial in the it's a distance in the coordinates. But it's a polynomial in the coordinates, therefore it's a function in the coordinates. Yes?
Letter that the power you're taking c to in that function.
Pardon?
You've written sum over operators of c of x1, x2 to the, is that a q or an a or what's the?
Well, the a here is just, it's not a power. I'm sorry, I should have written here. A is just an index which says that this function depends on the operator I consider. So for instance, in my case, for, let's just write it in that way, for in my case, the first operator, let us say, for a equals 0, let us say, I have an operator O0, which is identity, and the coefficient C0 corresponding is just a propagator, phi of x1, phi of x2. Okay. Now I have a second operator, which is phi squared. The normal product of phi squared and the coefficient associated to this operator is just 1. The constant function as a function of x1 and x2. And now I have a series of operators, and if I have an operator, let us label it by p and q. P and q is an index, which is the normal order of of phi, the corresponding coefficient, which is a function of x1 and x2, is simply 1 over factorial p, 1 over factorial q, x1 to the power k, x2 to the power q. Okay? Okay? So now, which coefficient are the more important? You see here that this coefficient is the most divergent because it's diverged like x1 minus 2 to the power 2 minus d, the dimension of space-time. And this coefficient is constant, and this coefficient are
more and more regular. Now, there is a simple rule which is very important, which is relates how those coefficients behave at short distance with the dimension of the operator. So, what is the dimension of the operators? By definition, if you consider a quantum operator, you can associate it a dimension, which is simply its dimension in terms of mass. So to any operators, O, which is an operator, I can associate something which I call the dimension of this operator, which is the dimension in units of, let us say, momenta, energies, or inverse of lengths, distances. Okay. So in GeV or in. Okay. And what is the dimension? And basically, what this dimension, you can obtain it by simply computing the short distance behavior of those two operators. And so what is the dimension of, and you can get also this dimension of this operator by just considering doing a scaling analysis, so dimensional analysis in the action. See, in the action, the original action of the free field theory is something like dx, d mu phi plus m squared phi. I don't specify whether I am in real time or Euclidean time because it's not important. So you see, but the action has to be dimensionless. So the dimension of the action has to be zero. Okay? X has dimension one. I'm sorry, with my rule, X has dimension minus one because I'm speaking of dimension in terms of units of momentum. Okay? So d mu has dimension one. Therefore, the field phi must have dimension. This has dimension zero. This has dimension minus d. This has dimension two. So x must have dimension d minus two divided by two. Okay, so the dimension of the field of the operator phi with my rules is the dimension of space-time minus two divided by two. You see? The dimension of the operator one identity is obviously zero because it's a pure number. You see? And so when you have two operators, in fact, here, C for the operator A of x1, x2 must behave as x1 minus x2 with a power which is minus 2 times the dimension of the operators phi, because you have 2 phi here, plus the dimension of the operator OA. Okay, and you check that it works. These terms behave like x minus y to the power 2 minus d. Okay, for the first term here in the expansion. For these terms, you get 1 because you have to the right 2 phi, and to the left, you have the dimension of square. So the dimension of the operator normal products of phi is twice the dimension of the operator phi. It's 2 minus d. And obviously, the dimension of the operator, when you have p derivative and q derivative, is equal to d minus 2 plus p plus q. Because you are taking p derivative, and each derivative has dimension plus 1. Okay. So, and I will hand up there. You see that in general, in fact. And now I state the general form of the operator product expansion. Now, an exercise, and I will discuss that a little bit next time. This formula is true in general. So for any local operators OA and OB of the series. And these operators can be phi, phi squared, phi to the 4, all the operators who have been defined before. You can always, there is a general formula, which is that OA of x1, OB of x2, when x1 and x2 goes to 0, can always be expanded as a sum over the operators OC of the series. Some coefficient, which now will be CAB, so it's some kind of tensor, which is a function of x1 and x2, times the operator OC of 0. Okay? Where here you have some function depending on the operators here, here, and the operator here. So it's some kind of tensor with one indices up and two indices down. It's a function of x1 and x2. Okay, and this function, in fact, will behave CA, CAB of x1 and x2 will behave when x1 and x2 goes to 0 as x1 minus x2 to some power, and this power will be always been given by such a formula. It will be the dimension of the operator OC minus the dimension of the operator OA minus the dimension of the operator OB. Okay? And what I've been doing in great detail in the very simple case of products of two phi operators, in fact, you can check by applying the Feynman rules that it is true for any operators which are of this form. In fact, it's true for any operator of the general forms, grad P1 of phi, grad P2 of phi, etc., grad P. N of phi, so you take any products of an arbitrary number of derivatives, space derivative of the phi, you define the normal products of this operator. It's a well-defined operator. And when now you are looking at the short distance behavior of such two operators, it always behaves like that. But then it may contain many, many, many different operators. But it has always a formula like that. And this formula is the Wilson general form of the Wilson operator product expansion. Okay? And it's something which is true. In fact, one can show that it is true. Once one has succeeded in constructing interactive quantum field theory, one can show that this is true also for interacting quantum theory. But now the operators are much more complicated objects that are just defined by a normal products of operator. Their dimension, the concept of the dimension of operator, is something which is non-trivial. It depends on the dynamics of the theory. The dimension of some operator is not just some integer number. It depends on the interaction of the theory. But this kind of expansion is always valid because the theory is local. Okay? So this tells us that if you have singularities contained in the, because you are computing expectation value of operators in some interacting theory, and you have some operators which come close together, this formula tells you that the singularities is always proportional to some other operators. So if you have short distance singularity, they keep a local structure because you have a function which contains, when you integrate over it, to give you singularities, and then times another local operators. So you see? So So the structure of short distance or high energy singularities in a quantum field series is always described by the content in local operator of the theory. Okay. And well, I will have to give you a few examples later before starting to discuss renormalization. But that's basically the structure of quantum field theory, which makes renormalization programs working by controlling the way the singularity, the short distance singularity in the theory, are contained.
The two-point case, the singularity was contained in the Feynman propagator.
Yes. Yes.
So do you mean that the singularities for
the more general case would then be contained more in the coefficients?
The singularities are always contained in the coefficients. We saw that in the case I computed, we had many coefficients. One of the coefficients was a propagator, and it was dangerous because it gives an infinite term. The other coefficients were harmless, but they were still there. And when we'll be computing operator product expansion for other operators, like phi squared, phi to the four, there will be more coefficients, and some this coefficient may contain products of propagator. Okay? So there will be more harmful coefficients, and we shall see their structure tomorrow. Okay? Thank you.
I just have a couple of announcements I'd like to make, please. The first thing is one thing we need to